No, I don't know that specifically. I just know that in that first summer of the ALRB, that first summer of elections, there were more than 40,000 farm workers that voted in that in that series of elections, you know, many, many elections. I don't know the nuances of what you're talking about there. That's probably because the general counsel's office for the ALRB probably handled that aspect of it. In other words, who was eligible to vote, who wasn't eligible to vote, and that'd be my hunch.
Yeah.
But I don't know who, how that all came about.
Yeah. Well, after it came about, I think there was a logistic problem of getting people back. Because that whole issue of those who had worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, at that point in time, you see, I was not on the ground with respect to the Farm Workers Union or its... See, I left in 1963, August of 1973, I left the union.
Mm-hmm.
And began over again. I started a new career, new careers. Mm-hmm. And while I didn't break, while it was a very friendly separation,
mm-hmm.
And my relationship with Caesar remained very good, it could no longer be the same. Anyone who has been involved in a movement or a cause understands that the friends are the people that you're working with on a daily basis, and when they spin out of the circle,
mm-hmm.
you don't say they're enemies, or you still say that's my friend,
yeah.
but it's not a working friend. Mm-hmm. It's not, and Caesar nor I are the kind of people that live in the past,
mm-hmm.
and so yeah. it's like. So I saw the union then as an outsider, if you will, and completely different perspective.
At one point, we were talking about finding a place. You know, looking in Santa Barbara and then settling in La Paz. You said that Cesar had this vision, dream of developing more than a union.
Right. Oh yes.
What was this more?
The way he explained it to himself was he wanted to have farm workers be able to participate in cooperatives,
mm-hmm.
co-ops. He thought that the credit union was one of the most was one of the most empowering things that had ever been developed for poor people. The idea that poor people could pool their money, as little as it was, mm-hmm. create a resource, and help one another, and expand their opportunity, and pay it back over an organized basis, and da 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 da. I mean, he took great personal delight and pleasure in the idea of, and he participated in the credit mm-hmm. union, and sold it to others and farm workers. I mean, you know, he marketed it. We had a gas station co-op,
mm-hmm.
which was more or less a failure, more or less a success, depends, you know. I mean, it was, you know. But farm workers absolutely dependent upon their automobile.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a piece of junk, right? I mean, it just barely runs.
Yeah.
And you got to take it to a shade tree mechanic, or you got to work on it yourself. God, why not have a place? If he talked about this once, he talked about it 1,000 times. Why not have a place where farm workers could bring their cars, have access to tools and this and that? And even if they had to work on their own car, at least they'd, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah. The car was so vital to their livelihood. I mean, how could you have a movement, how could you have a union,
yeah.
for example, that wasn't interested in their car?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, mm-hmm. it was just, see, a medical clinic. I mean, he was absolutely determined that he knew that if the union were ever built, he told me he didn't expect any contracts for the first 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they came within the first 4 or 5 years was just totally mind-boggling to him. He looked upon it as a 20-year project. And And he knew that at some point the union would either be built or not built. But if it were built, there would be funds for a medical plan, this kind of thing. He was just absolutely refused to turn this money over to insurance companies to let them handle it and to let them... He thought insurance companies were a total ripoff of poor people. And so he wanted to have the kind of plan where the workers, if you will, control... In other words, be self-funded. They controlled the money, they controlled the benefits, that there was not these profits paid to insurance companies for basically handling the bureaucratic nonsense. And so that was, I mean, and then he believed in preventive health care. My God, he was 30 years ahead of his time. I mean, he wanted to invest money in prevention, not in urgent care, not in long-term hospitalization. He thought that was a total rip-off of working people, that so much of the money was spent on the catastrophic illness end, and not on the family end, the, you know, raising your kids, having access to doctors and immunizations and you know, when you cut yourself, being able to, you know, go to the emergency room and have it paid for and this and that, that kind of stuff. And he was, you know, he was just he was a very progressive thinker along those lines. And he did not see labor leaders doing that. I mean, and he faulted them for that. Not all of them. Yeah. I mean, in the sense, not across the board. Yeah. Some were more than others. But I mean, in terms of the labor movement, he felt that they lost it. They didn't, you know. So I don't know. Maybe that shed some.
Okay. Now I just, you know, you said that developed more than a union. So I want to know what is this more than?
Right.
Another issue, you know, kind of running through the 63 to 73 period we're talking about here, the question of religiosity, spirituality. Take, for example, the fasts. There are, you know, a variety of opinions about them, whether it was an intrusion of a religious activity into something that is not religious.
In Caesar's mind. Yeah. I mean, Caesar saw religion as part and parcel of your daily life, his daily life. And so religious symbols were important to the people, and therefore they were important to the movement. Caesar was a religious person. That doesn't mean he attended church constantly. He didn't, but he attended church a lot. When I say attended church, I mean the church came to the union. After all, I mean we had more masses within the union than could last you a couple lifetimes. You know what I mean? I mean, you didn't have to. Caesar wasn't the kind of person who went to mass every Sunday. That was not what he did. I think it's just second nature to Caesar, and after all, I mean, he's dealing with people. The banner of Our Lady of Guadalupe was led the Mexican Revolution. He saw he saw nothing wrong with that. He thought that was. Yeah, that's the way it is.
Been done 150 years before,
well,
right?
Right. He never saw that as an issue. Now you say there's controversy about it, whatever. There might be controversy about it now, but there didn't seem to be a lot of controversy about it at the time.
Sometimes in retrospect, people will develop.
True.
Different perspectives,
absolutely. Yeah. I'm not naive. I mean, there were people associated with the union, even some board members of the union who were not so religiously inclined, if you will, at that level. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the gospel level kind of thing. And what opt for a more traditional labor union type of deal? Well, they sort of had to make a choice, and there was a tough choice for some, and some didn't want to make it, and some made it, and some made it part-time one way and part-time another way. You know what I mean? It was just like, I mean, but the fact is that Caesar's charisma, of course, and engendered by the people, by the farm workers themselves, really, truly overpowered those differences to the extent that they were there. And it's like you either tolerated him if you wanted to be part of it, or you had to ignore it, or you had to leave. Or I mean, you know what I mean? It was there were no long arguments, believe me, or debates or sessions about, well, should we or shouldn't we? Or I mean, that's just Caesar and the people, and that's, you know, there's a lot of spontaneity that happens. Yeah. I mean, when you talk about the fast and Caesar, I mean, the idea was he wanted to have a mass every day there. Well, the people came, primarily women, Filipinos and Mexicans and Anglos, and made an altar and decorated it and puts up symbols. And I mean, Caesar didn't say, do this, do that. I mean, it was like, this is what you're going to do. I mean, the fasting was a religious type of activity, and people treated it that way. It also turned out to be one of the most effective organizing tools he ever developed. But so, I mean,
that was a result of it.
You know, I don't think he intended it that way. I don't think he knew what was going to happen.
Dolores Campos was just telling us last Sunday, wasn't it, that about a group of women who nightly prayed the rosary. They would gather. So it's just that sometimes the hall at 40 Acres would be full. He says,
During the fast?
During the fast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it says people, they just come together and in the evening.
There was no one announced that we're going to have a rosary.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I mean, people came from Arizona. People came from hundreds and hundreds of miles away to be part of this happening. Mm-hmm. And they brought themselves, and they brought what, you know what I mean? They came to a holy act. Yeah. And they brought their religious customs, they brought their religious, their prayers, they brought their, whoever they were. Yeah. We had Indian dancers and, I mean, gosh, I mean, people coming to lay hands on Caesar. I mean, ministers. I don't mean from the middle class community. I'm talking about even from the Mexican community. I mean, people who saw the power of this person and wanted to be part of it. And
you say ministers from the Mexican community? You're talking evangelicals, or
even in that time,
So he was able to cut across those.
Yes, he was, and Caesar had very high regard. He had very high regard for them, and he did not see them as a threat. Mm-hmm. Caesar was very ecumenical. He was very open. Also, I think Caesar saw the evangelicals as doing more for the people than the traditional parishes, or the traditional Catholic parishes, at least at that time.
Yeah.
They were more involved people. Mm-hmm. People had, they empowered people more.
Yeah, with the emphasis on fellowship.
Yes, and leadership. They developed leadership, and they had a program, and they. Yeah. No. Caesar. No. See, I don't know where Caesar learned this. I don't really know, but he would never permit any of us to attack or to complain against our natural allies.
Mm-hmm.
And our natural allies, first and foremost, the church, regardless of faith, labor unions, regardless. As much as he had deep-seated feelings about any and all of them, or we did, or, you know, this person or that person, I mean, our natural friends, we had to we had to take into account their mm-hmm. their problems, their annoyances with us, their after all, Caesar mm-hmm. was a crusader, and mm-hmm. he was, he just ran cross purposes to yeah. most labor leaders, for example. They thought he was, he wouldn't negotiate. He was too dictatorial. Mm-hmm. He was too arrogant. He was too this. He was too that. Because mm-hmm. that's how they saw it. Well, it doesn't mean he changed. Maybe he was tempered somewhat, but he didn't change. But he didn't rail against them. He didn't mm-hmm. piss on them. He didn't yeah. get yeah. into a fight with them. Mm-hmm.
What was interesting on the religious thing and the evangelicals is that, the earlier influences of the mission band. I remember things with Padre Arturo coming through town with his big Dodge Power Wagon and the altar that they would open up on the back. But one of the consistent lines was no good Mexicans and Alleluia. In other words, you don't join the evangelicals, but it's somehow a betrayal of your Mexicanness, even. And yet.
No, that was not.
So Cesar can draw something from the mission band and yet yeah. let that set aside.
Let that set aside. No, yeah. that's right. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the right. There's only one issue that I think that Caesar had a very difficult time with setting aside. I don't think he could set it aside, and that's abortion.
Mm-hmm.
I think the women's movement was difficult for Caesar.
Yeah.
I think it was difficult for a lot of us.
Yeah, I was going to say a whole lot of us have had to rethink some
That's
things.
That's right. Yes. And I think Caesar was a wonderful rethinker. He was a wonderful rethinker, mm-hmm. though. He incorporated new things. He was open to new things. I mean, all of this business, the gardening and the vegetarianism and the this and that. That's openness to new things. Mm-hmm. had he been hidebound in the way he was raised and the way, the mission band and Catholicism at that point, he would have been closed to those things. But he wasn't. He was very open to this. Abortion, I think, is one of the things that Caesar had, I think, he had troubles. I know he did. Well, I know he did. I don't think. I know. He couldn't see another side to it, another nuance to it, another.
Mm-hmm. It leads me to ask a question about something that there's been a lot of controversy swirled around, and that's the involvement with Synanon. Do you think that his propensity for listening and absorbing and arriving at new points and being able to disregard old ideas made that look or made Synanon appeal to him? That's part of what appealed to him, and that was part of an effort to.
I could cop out and say, because it's true, I was long gone before the Synanon, mm-hmm. influences yeah. or whatever. I mean, August 73, I was gone, and that wasn't even a factor. Wasn't even on the horizon. That happened later on. Many other things happened later on, and I wasn't part of it. And so, it would be conjecture on my part. But I will conjecture something. Everyone has, can do that, I guess. But it's sheer conjecture, really. I think a lot of things, but I think when I first met Caesar, I was convinced that the way to help poor people was education. And he was able to convince me that the best way to help poor people was to organize them. And I examined my experience as a high school teacher, and I understood that the people that I was teaching and having some influence on, and I could see going on to becoming doctors and thinkers and this and whatever, businessmen, whatever, were sons of people who had been organized. They were, like in San Francisco, they were primarily sons of parents whose father was a member of a labor union. Mm-hmm. They had some economic stability. They had some base, and they had, therefore, some money that they could send their kid to a private school and, therefore, send their kid on to college. I mean, so what does come first, the chicken or the egg? And I said, well, you know, I really believe that, and I still believe, truly, that Caesar was right, that organization, stability, family stability, whatever, comes first if you're going to have education or some of these other kinds of things. He didn't decry that at all. It's just that where are you going to start? And you only have so much to give and so much of your life, and you know what? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
All right, now I think, you know, in a strange way, and this is my conjecture, I think in a strange way that Caesar came around at some point to thinking and to having convinced himself and believing that everything could be taught. Union administration could be taught, or administration could be taught, or that it was all in the books. Mm-hmm. It was all in the professors who wrote these books. And if you brought them and if you talked to them, I saw this in Jerry Brown too. You talk to them and you bring them and they inform you and they can teach you and therefore I can teach others and da da da. And I know that Caesar, I was gone, you have to realize this. So, but some of the times that I talked to Caesar and some of my friends afterwards, I mean, they were into heavy reading about management and management theory and intellectual, I mean, thinking and processing and how to, you know, that kind of thing. And
like the dialogue with Freire and these kinds of things? Paulo Freire, remember that?
Yes, but there, who was the other? The one guy from Claremont, the professor at Claremont, who wrote all these. Drucker, was he from Claremont?
Yeah, Theodore Drucker, right?
Yeah,
Theodore Drucker, right?
Yeah, I mean, didn't he write all?
He's all this management on management,
right?
Yeah, right.
And I know that.
One of the first of the contemporary gurus of re-engineering, reinventing. And
Exactly. Okay. Now, I wasn't there, but I know that there was contact. I know that there was seminars. I know that there was readings. I know, I know because I heard it. That's, you know, what do I? But I wonder if Synanon, for example, represented that aspect of Caesar who felt that personality or people's motivations or...
the slogan, the people business, Synanon, the people business.
Okay, that can be managed, it can be taught, it can be, I don't want to say manipulated, that's a cruel word, but it, you know what I mean? It's just to learn. I mean, it's just, you just learn it and then you can master it, and then you can. Well, I mean, I think I think that's simplistic, and I'm not saying Caesar is simplistic. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that maybe Caesar became, in a strange way, the most intellectual of us all. I mean, the most maybe he became the most. Yeah. The highest academician, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That everything is a science. It just can be, it can be taught. Yeah. First of all, it can be learned, and it can be taught.
Yeah. This idea of the organic intellectual, and he would be a prime example then of the organic intellectual rather than an academician as intellectual.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, he may be evolved to that point, you see, because he was a very brilliant person, but maybe evolved to the point where, you know, I mean, maybe he became his own ivory tower. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just making it up. I don't know.